Yeah, I wonder if we're a two-man crew.
I'm thinking it's two-man crew. That's the name of this episode, two-man crew.
This show is not for the easily offended, so if you are easily offended, go listen to something else.
Whoa.
All right, so are you ready to do this?
You're supposed to say, it's a two-man crew.
No, it's a two-man crew.
I hear people like the two-man crew.
Well, welcome back, folks. Indie Comic Book Noise 421. We were batting around some different things, and unfortunately, we're a little light today in the crew. Hence the two-man crew. Probably doesn't take a long-term fan of Indie Comic Book Noise to guess that two-man crew, but in the interest of everyone's podcast, as someone's first, I'm Andrew, hosting the show down in L.A., and number one Indie Comic Book Noise contributor, Kevin, WWX up in Canada. Say hi, Kevin. Yes.
Hello.
He's also manning the show, your traditional two-man crew. Indie Comic Book Noise is part of the Deliberate Noise Network. You can find us online at indiecomicbooknoise.com, where you can go back and listen to literally hundreds of episodes, including point episodes, addendums, small bonus episodes, and the regularly numbered ones. You can also find us on Twitter, Indie Comic Book N. Kevin and I and other sometime contributors have handles that go along there on their own. But Kevin and I are on Twitter a lot. Steve is on somewhat, and Phil is almost never on, so hopefully we'll hear from Phil later. On this show, we talk about properties and things of interest that are not big two, i.e. DC and Marvel related, although sometimes they have some tangential connection to those big two, because the world of comic books is somewhat crossovery, intentionally and unintentional.
This will sound bad, but this is but I don't mean it to sound bad, but it seems like this show is also a dumping ground for like industry or con or just general comic talk, which also I think fits better usually with when you cover like beyond like the big two and talk about other general comic subjects.
Yes, we're not really a news show, obviously, given our sporadic release schedule, but we do discuss trends, as Kevin said, shows we go to, media tie-ins, those sorts of things. So there is some topicality to it, but I feel like it's more things of interest, more than like, hey, did you hear that Howard signed a new exclusive contract with Marvel or something like that, which is all well and good, but I can't imagine most people aren't getting that sort of news directly from ye old internet. Although I feel like the comic websites have dried up quite a bit.
Yeah, I feel like if someone did a news podcast nowadays, like I would actually listen to it, where before I wouldn't have.
It feels like you really do have to hunt and scratch around to get something that's not inundated with pop-up ads or press releases or things like that. I'm a little bit unplugged from most of the news because I feel like I can let it filter down, but sometimes you do want to find something out, mainly release dates and things like that, and it can be shocking that I sometimes can't find that information.
Well, it's just something like, remember there was that series I was interested in that from Dark Horse, like that Gamma, which started, it was like the, what was the pitch? It was like Pokemon Monster Hunter type of thing crossed with something else. I don't know. I just remember, I think it was in Dark Horse Presents, and they used to release all those things. Well, I shouldn't say all of them. Some of the stories got
Collected.
Yeah, in like little one-shots. And they were going to do another miniseries. And like the first issue came out, and then a few months goes by, and I'm like, where's the second issue? And like you can still find like random solicits for like future issues, But it's like that issue, like obviously there's like you didn't miss an issue, like something's going on, but can you try to find on the internet like what happened or where is this, like is it canceled, like what's going on? Like no, like there's no immediate information.
Yeah, it's just frustrating. Well, I also feel, I don't know. No, I'm not going to say it. Never mind. Scratch that. I'm keeping it positive. Andy's turning it around. Too much of a negative, nattering nabob of negativity. I'm going to try and be a positive ray of sunshine.
So it's kind of funny that while you might not want to look up creators for various reasons, like maybe you just... you just don't want to know about them, right? You're just like, I'm enjoying your comics. I don't want to know anything about you. No one talks about you. But the only place sometimes you can find that information about what's going on with their comic is actually at their account on like whatever type of service they're using.
I do. I will say one thing. At shows, I find Twitter to be very useful because it tends to update appearances and signings and what's going on where. I find that's a resource that even if you're not a big fan of Twitter in general, I've told people in the past, it's good to sign up just for shows alone and just have lists of like people at that show because they'll usually say, and a lot of times the convention itself won't update and provide things like, you know, who's signing where. Because a lot of times they're signing at their thing, or they're signing with the publisher, or they'll be surprise guests. I think I mentioned last time, maybe it was the last LA Comic Con, where Tim Seeley wasn't in any of the paperwork whatsoever. I actually found him in Artist Alley, but if I was on Twitter, I would have seen, oh, he's there going it. So I always try and search whatever the hashtag is for the show. Although it's annoying that I don't like it when shows don't capitalize on that. The good shows always, you know, have their information, have their social media handle, have whatever search terms like, you know, C2E2 2019 or whatever it's going to be. And those are always super useful for me, I find. I mean, obviously this is for the bigger shows. For like your smaller long box hunting shows, you don't really need that.
This is true.
But speaking of which, Kevin, I hear you have been to a show recently.
Oh, I went to Toronto Comic Con. Again.
And this is... Is this the big show? This is not the one that's held in the library with all the art comics.
This is not general... Well, I shouldn't say it's not general comics audience. This is the small fan expo.
Okay, so do we still have media guests coming or just comics?
It's been many years since it was just basically comics. Well, it's funny, like they used to do Fan Expo and then like, well, this is before they got bought out too. Like, I shouldn't say like they made these decisions because that was before, you know, present management. But
I also don't fault a show. Look, it drives traffic. Like, you want to have the cast of the latest CW show or whatever, it's going to bring, you know, ticket buyers into the crowd.
Like people didn't like the previous... Some people didn't like the way the previous, you know, group ran the show. But they did have a fan appreciation show in March that they called it, and it was basically just comics. And you don't have basically a just comics show. You know, they have a little bit of everything.
Did you feel appreciated?
I mean, it was a little weird because remember you were talking about those changes in, I guess, ways to combat fraud and different ways to enter shows and stuff like that, right?
Yes, the latest, in fact, I will be attending, the show will be over by the time this comes out, but I'm attending WonderCon, which is put on by the same people that do San Diego, and they like to do RFID chips installed in your badge, so you have to tap poles to get in and out.
So this was the first show that had that.
How'd it go?
I was a little uneasy about it because of certain things that weren't exactly clear, and I think I understand why now. But even with that, like, it went well. Like, I didn't have any problems.
Well, that's a plus.
I know. So, and there's pros and cons, but would I have liked to have known these certain things before going to the show? Of course. Did I try different things out to see if the system was going to break down or not? I'm like, yeah.
My favorite, the ones I go to, it's installed in your badge. So every entrance and exit has posts that you tap in and tap out. And they make you tap out so that when you come back the next day and tap in, it shows you came and went. And usually for the last day of the show, whatever it is for me, even if it's not the last, I always never tap out. So I always walk out and like to think that their computer system show, I never left their con until the next year when I have a new badge and I'm a new person. But that's me being silly.
We didn't have any of that, Andrew. Like, we didn't have the...
Really? No, like, tapping in or tapping out?
We had the tapping in. I shouldn't say anything, but it, you know when you say, oh, there's some pole or some monument or some kind of strange object you have to walk towards, like a monolith, like some kind of ape or something?
Well, I was thinking more, you know, 4 foot high plastic stanchions that you walk by. But I do like your idea of a monolith where I'm transformed by my interaction with it to my next plane of evolution.
So that was the weird part. I'm like, because they wanna capture everyone, right?
Yeah. They wanna, that's so presumably to stop people from sneaking in, right? I don't know if they work, by the way, but I assume that's the reason why.
Well, I assume it works. It would work better in this system than your system, where people can just randomly come and go.
I would. Well, my understanding is also, as the RFID tech gets better, they can have disguised ports around, so you don't have to hold it, you know, 2 inches away. It can read it from several feet away. The other advantage is that opens up marketing data. They can place them all around the floor, and then they have hard proof of what traffic patterns are like and hard data, and they can analyze. Okay, so over 3 days of the show, this area saw 80% more traffic than this. You know what I mean? It would allow them to, in the future, align their shows once they get those RFID readers to a higher level. Plus, it allows conspiracy theories to make people think that they're reading their minds or giving them cancer or whatever.
Wow. So they're not going to make the floor plan better. They'll just squeeze out the comics and put in more celebrities is what you're saying. I thought you had turned over a new leaf.
Well, remember, though, the problem with those celebrities is that costs them a lot of money. They can't just chock full of that because a lot of times, my understanding is sometimes they don't even make that much off them, like, because the celebrities get such a big chunk of money themselves. So the people like you that just buy tables, well, that's all profit to them. So they don't want, you know, it's nice to have people buying tables because then they're making money off that more directly. Now, some of the celebrities, they no doubt make money. I'm sure it depends, but I believe it's a more complicated ecosystem and rules of all that. Or you would see a lot more shows that are 99% celebrity.
So I'll lay down for you what happened. I find out about these badges on the website, and it's like, it's talking about, you know, activation, registration, to get into the show. Very brief FAQ. Of course, I have the questions like, what if someone doesn't have a cell phone? What if you don't have access to Wi-Fi? You know, all the usual questions.
So the point of this is you have to activate it on your cell phone. At the show or beforehand, or you don't know?
At the show. And of course, I'm assuming that if you can't, you can run back or out of the con and activate it somewhere else, right?
You would think, because I know at some shows, Wi-Fi can be touch and go.
Yeah. So the funny thing is, once I got to the show, it's like you were in a lineup where it would have been very hard to turn around and go back to your hotel room if you absolutely needed to activate this thing. You're like, you're in a lineup to go into the show.
So were you able to activate it on your phone, or do you not have a cell phone?
See, this is the thing. I can access the free Wi-Fi, but the con is several levels into the ground, surrounded by concrete. So the room you pick up your tickets in doesn't have Wi-Fi. Only the hallway that goes into the con has Wi-Fi. And you should be activating before you go into the show. So I'm like, well, this is interesting. But the thing is, like their badge says activation, like, required. But activation is required if you want to have the benefits associated with having the chip in your card. Of course, it doesn't say that. And of course, you can get in without activating. But they're all like, activation is required. Remember this, people. Make sure you activate, etc., etc.
So did you activate, or did you just go in and flash your badge?
The second day I activated, because I was thinking like you, and I'm like, well, maybe you want to know how it, like, how it goes if you activate and if you don't activate, right?
Yeah.
But this whole situation where it says it's required, of course, leaves people going, I don't have anything, or what am I supposed to do, type of thing. And of course, there's people around with, like, iPads to, like, register you, because I'm like, that would only make sense, right? If people... It would be foolish to think that everyone just automatically has something or has data available,
yes,
for their thing they just introduced.
Especially if it's like a travel show or something and people came from far away, you don't always have, you know, or you're saving it, you don't have a ton of data available. I think that's completely true. Besides, it's kind of cheap of them to make me use my data. Like,
well, that's what I was thinking. If there's only a post, maybe they need, like, less employees, because they had to have all these people either there, or maybe they went on to their regular jobs at the con after. But you always needed a certain amount of people there. And I'm just, like, wondering at what point, if they don't judge the amount of people they need or have enough room... Like, there's some of these things could become choke points at some point. Because there's already, when panel rooms let out, is one area, there's, like, a massive choke point. But this con is smaller, so the con starts, like, further inside the building. So I'm assuming for Fan Expo, if they do this, they're going to have to start the con and the check-in and everything, like, way before you get to the con. Otherwise, it's going to be total logjam, I imagine, if you get too many people or too few employees. Because once you walk into the con, like, they also have an iPad in, like, pretty strict lines where they scan you into the show, and when you leave, they scan you out.
Okay, sadly for the big American shows here, the choke point is always security. Like, there's always some stupid bag check at most of these that is of varying levels of success, or a metal detector, which I think I prefer. It seems to go faster. Or a few shows I've heard of, I haven't been to any of these, but I think this is the best. They just have increased security presence and, like, dogs or whatever, and they don't have hardly any obvious kind of bag searching or whatever. They just have the place flooded with cops and presumably undercover people and all that, and I think that's a better method than... Because we've all been through bag checks, and, you know, they're never consistent. Like, some people check everything. Other times, when it gets backed up, I notice, they tend to just sort of wave people, cursory, you know, peer in and wave people through. And it's a con. Everyone has a bag. Like, well, not every, but, you know, and what, 99% of the people there have bags or short boxes or whatever.
But it started, like, I was there before the show on the first day. And, like, after people pick up their badge, it sort of leads them to start milling around, trying to get onto their mobile devices to activate rather than go line up. So there's always a little bit of that anyways, because people, like, even if you have, like, the wristband, people are all like, oh, I gotta get this on, gotta put this stuff away, or whatever. Like, you're holding on to something, you just wanna do whatever you need to do. But there was, a lot of time to do that, like, in line. And it was pretty good lines, like, that day. But I noticed that one person said, like, they didn't like the wrist thing before, because if you go for, like, a long con, like, you might have to go to work or whatever, and you have to make sure you don't break the wrist strap. So it's like, what if you're, like, washing dishes or just doing things? So, like, the badge sort of removes you of that restriction.
I don't like the wristband shows. Although, if they do, I prefer when they have each day as a different color. So that way, at least you can take it off at the end of the day and put on the next badge. You know, the next color. Because I also like to put it on myself. I hate when they put it on you. Because I'm a big hairy guy. So, like, they always catch all my arm hair in it and everything. And I'm always just like, can I just put it on? But some shows are always weird. Like, I'm running outside and selling it to someone else. Or I don't know what their issue is.
I've never had a show where they put it on me. And they also, like, you can usually pick up with the wristband. Like, even for your, like, because it might be for yourself. You just don't want to stand in line the next day. They'll give you.
Yes. Yeah, that they'll usually. And I've never had problem usually picking up for, like, my wife or if I have. Yeah. You know, they see it's the same last name, and we paid for the tickets together. And I've never had anyone do that sort of thing where they're like, I'm always nervous, but they usually let it go. Because I'm like, look, we have the same last name. Like, we bought the tickets together. I'm not picking random names with my last name and hoping they also bought a ticket so I can steal it. Like, yeah, it does look hard to be a volunteer staff at these things. Or, I mean, I figure those jobs should be paid people. If you're having to deal with that level of customer service, I feel like volunteers are good for line management and things like that. But I feel like the important stuff, they should be paying people for that.
So I couldn't pick up my next day badge, I guess, with the new system. I don't know. They're like, no, just come tomorrow, pick up the Saturday chip badge color thing.
Although I will say the one thing I like about these RFID shows, they mail you your badges if you pay for them ahead of time. So I don't have any kind of I just have to show up. I have my WonderCon badge already. I mean, I do have to go through security, but I don't have to do any kind of check-in or log-in or any of that stuff. I have my badge. I'm ready to go.
They always used to mail you, but it always seemed, like, really expensive, like $20 or something to mail. And I'm like, what?
Oh, my God. How is so? What, are they mailing, like, them from Finland or something?
I know. Like, it's ship books for cheaper. I'm like, what are you sending?
No,
I don't
really
know. Maybe it's insured or something.
Yeah, that might be it. I think with the chips now, they're not worried about people counterfeiting the badges, so they'll mail them out. And that's the nice thing. I never did like having to, you know, we all have our printouts or our phones and they have to scan it and all that. So that saves time.
Oh, yeah. That was the other thing. They changed the website and they switched to one of those, what is it, QR code? Type of, like, it used to be a barcode, now it's like the QR code thing.
Yes.
But, like, the website doesn't work on certain browsers.
Well, not just that, but they're always, I feel like the QR codes, they're always, like, having to move the reader back and forth. They're, like, playing, like, an accordion with it, or, like, it never, and if the lighting is bad, that also, they're like, can you please turn your screen up, or, you're like, you know how people keep their screen dark to save their battery and everything, and I feel like, is this really that much faster? But I guess it is. I don't know. It must be, right?
So that was probably the most annoying thing, that they had launched a new website and everything. And I was just like, I never had a problem with, like, browser compatibility or private viewing or cookies or whatever. But there was some weird combination that I couldn't figure out. And then I just had to use a different browser on the from home when I bought the tickets. But anyways, on the next day, so I went to go pick up my badge. I didn't want to stand in a, like, for half an hour early before the show. And I'm like, this tactic usually works, where if you don't want to stand in a line, you don't have to be the first one on the floor. Show up like 10 minutes after opening, and part of that crowd has already gone in. Of course, now that when you go in, there isn't the organized lineups anymore. Now there's just clusters of people all over, either trying to activate or around volunteers with their iPads trying to activate people. So I went through with that to see how the process was and everything. But it was the first time I actually had passed everyone, because I guess everyone was booked up. And then one of the Toronto Comic Con people was like, "Oh, did you activate your thing?" And I'm like, "No, I didn't see anyone." So they're like, "Head back. There's someone there. One of those clusters of people. There's people in there."
But why, what's in it for you to go back and get it activated? What does it give you a benefit that helps you out?
That's the funny thing. They say required, and I'm like, yeah, for the benefits. But I've also saw people just screw this, and they just walked in. And by walked in, I mean they got scanned in, but they walked in without activating. But yeah, it's if you lose your badge, they can give you another one and deactivate the other one. Because supposedly someone ripped you off and now is using your badge, right?
Yeah.
So then if they try to do anything with the badge, they're not going to be able to do anything.
Yeah, I'll take my... I'm sure it's going to happen, but I'm going to worry about that. I've been to a lot of shows, don't remember losing tons of my badges or whatever.
I don't know. But I guess people rip their badges or need a replacement or it gets lost every year, and I'm like, I wouldn't want to be that person. It's not something that... It doesn't seem like something that would easily happen, but I guess that's cool. And then, I guess if they're like, "Oh, you can sign up for our emails and, stuff like that, or get notifications and, but I think the primary benefit is if something happens to your badge."
Okay. Well, the primary benefit is they can figure out who's doing what and they get
the primary benefit to you, Andrew.
I think they're getting a fair number of benefits out of it.
I know, and it's required. But really, no. Out of all the problems that could potentially happen, nothing happened. I tried both ways. It was fine. It was just a little nebulous when they say is required. And I'm like, you can still go into the show. And I don't think some people realize you could still go into the show.
Well,
but I'm sure they got there eventually.
Yeah. I mean, they just had to wait an extra 45 minutes while they got checked in or whatever. Well,
I know. You could bypass all these people just standing around and just get scanned to go in.
Nice.
But if you're... I remember you saying if you're coming and going, it's better to...
They make you check. Each time you have... they won't... It's by the security check-in. And if your badge doesn't click or light green or whatever, then you have to go to some other person and tell them why you're, what happened to your badge, why didn't you check in, why isn't it working. I've never had a problem with RFID reader not working, but I do also make sure I click in and out. It doesn't take, just as you walk through the, you hold it up to the plastic thing and it lights up and it's all done. But I can, at first I was very nervous. But like I said, because we have to go through security checks, it's not any bigger hassle on this end for the shows that do that.
Yeah, I wasn't there for the opening on the bigger day, so I don't know if that really slowed down the entry. I was there within 10 minutes of opening, and there was no lineup anymore. So I assume they scanned everything, and everyone got in relatively quickly. So,
well, you also got to think this tech has been around for they're not on the cutting edge of the first show that's ever so you think they could, whatever technical issues have probably been well discussed and broken out and changed and fixed. You'd hope, even if it hasn't been done by them, somebody out there, and I'm sure they all buy the software from the same vendor.
They tried it on you first.
Well, San Diego was the first one, and then WonderCon, and then a few others. I think once they realized that, like I said, I'm unsure about the counterfeit issues, but it seems to, once operationally, it seems fine. And like I said, they get all that great data they can mine to figure out how to make their show better. So how was the show?
I know.
20 now minutes on the show.
Oh, it was a good show. I mean, I bought a lot of comics, found some deals, got to catch up with. This is the weird thing. This year, like, I didn't run into any, like, I ran into people I know, but it's like vendors, you know. It's not like
no gobo.
Oh, it was so weird. It's like people either weren't there or, I don't know, everyone seemed to be busy doing something else, or they weren't going to go this year or something. I was like, ugh. But I kept busy anyway, so.
Head in the long... That's why you didn't see anyone. Your head was buried in long boxes. You got to look up once in a while.
You joke about that, but literally when people find me and they know I'm at the show and I can't find them, and then I hear some voice in the background, I take my head out of a long box that's on the floor, and they're like, hello! And I'm like, how did you find me here? How could you tell that was me with my head in a long box under a table?
That's how they know. They're like, we're just going to go to where the dusty long boxes are. And the one guy that's not sneezing, because he's built up an immunity to all the weird mold and creatures that live in dusty old long boxes.
I mean, the artist alley, I guess, could have been a little better. Like, you had some, like, bigger names, like a Phil Noto or, like, Mike Zeck, people like that, Denny O'Neill. Somehow, I don't
Those
know how
big
I did,
names.
But I was going to go to the O'Neill panel. But for some reason, I couldn't figure out the schedule, or I messed up the time or something, and it just didn't happen, which was sad.
Yeah, I mean, it's good to get on those panels. You know, those guys aren't going to be doing those panels forever.
It was like the Don Rosa panel from like a year ago. I'm like, yeah, I got to hit these panels. And then I don't know what the mix-up was, but somehow I missed that panel. I was like looking around at the panel rooms. I'm like, I don't see it. And then I'm like tired, and I'm like, I need a break anyway. So,
well, if you had logged in, you would have known. Had a little.
I know.
Map.
I would have downloaded the app, gone onto the free Wi-Fi, and checked the schedule for sure. Maybe they would have told me it had moved to another room. I don't know. I don't know.
So did you see any panels, or that was the only one you were going to and you didn't make it?
Yeah, that was pretty much the only one, because a lot of them are like traditional panels, or I guess I could have went to a sketch duel, but I was also like checking out the Harley Yee stuff or CGC or whatever, so that takes up a little bit of time.
Did you dip your toe into the CGC water?
I did.
Whoa. I want to hear. That's what I want to hear. This is, I did not picture you as a CGC man.
I know. It's not really relevant to the indie noise.
I don't care. I want to hear it.
I don't. Yeah, so it was under $100.
Okay.
So, yeah. It was, I started going around.
So first appearance of Peter Porker is what I'm guessing?
That's over 100.
Yeah, but anyone buying that?
I don't know.
I saw one over Raw, not graded, but I don't know that people are purchasing that.
Well, just like I saw the ROMs for like $100 now, and I'm like, there's that guy who had a bag of ROM for $120 for years, and then I assume it's the same bag. I don't know, maybe he had multiple bags, and then one here, he's just like, this isn't selling, and it's like $40, and then I'm like, sold.
Well, now,
like ROM 1 to 35 or whatever.
Now it's time, Kevin. We haven't reached peak ROM yet?
I don't think so. We would have to ask a ROM expert, I think, on that. But I would say it's not peak ROM.
So what
book? He doesn't have a Romnibus.
So what book did you, what, was this the first CGC book you've purchased out in the wild?
Is it? No, it isn't. No.
Oh.
No, that was Fan Expo last year.
So what'd you get this year? I'm curious.
I got, this will be funny, Spider-Man 299.
Oh, yeah. Nice. Number one?
Yes.
All right.
I'm thinking this probably isn't worth that much to begin
I've been looking at grabbing one because I got that page from the first issue. So I've been all over eBay and everything. And in my show, I might be looking for a nice copy just to have it.
So, yeah, but I was going around sort of like it was the last. Not like they try to get you to leave the show before it closes, but you know, they're sort of like, wrap up your purchases, and I'm like, there's another 15 minutes left. I'm like, I'm not wrapping up. I'm looking for good purchases.
You can't tell a player like you to leave. You're there getting those last minute deals. That's when the deals start. You think Harley Yee wants to pack up all those books and go home?
Oh, I've never bought anything from him.
I don't know that I have either. There's like...
He always has like, I don't know, like Iron Man number one or whatever, but it's, I don't know.
I don't feel that his prices are what I'm comfortable paying. They may very well be worth that, and I may have an unrealistic expectation. So I'm not a massive buyer. I only buy when I feel comfortable, and the prices I may pay may not reflect the value. And they might reflect it both ways. I don't know. You know, maybe I'm overpaying for some books and underpaying for some, but all I can go by is what value I put on it.
Yeah.
And there's nothing I want so bad that I feel like, oh, if I don't get it, I'm doomed.
Well, that's the big lesson, right? A comic's only worth what someone's willing to pay.
Yeah. Well, to me it is. But I know that as long as for certain books, there seems to be, at the higher end, a value that goes way past that.
Well, I mean, like, a comic could be, like, worthless with the cover ripped off, but someone thinks, oh, this is worth $100 to me. Well, to that person, it is $100, even though,
oh, I see,
it's not worth $100.
I see individual pages of AF-15 that are graded. No grade, of course. That people sell.
AF-15.
Yeah, but pages that aren't part of the Spider-Man story I've seen.
Ooh.
Being auctioned off. They're part of that book, but do you want, you know, whatever random page from that? And coverless comics, but single pages are my current interesting thing. If I can find one cheap, I may buy a graded single page of a comic. Well, my oldest comic, The Owl, from the 40s is no grade because it's coverless. But I thought it'd be kind of cool. And I paid, you know, $10 or something for it. So it wasn't a significant expenditure. But I was just like, oh, it'll be really cool to have this kind of old-timey book from way back when. And it was kind of a funny gimmick. I wasn't serious. But yeah, it's weird how these things now all have value just because people are mad for it. So, if you have a really valuable book, don't throw it out, even if it has missing the cover or pages out or on single. I mean, it has to be really valuable. I did, through my friend's eBay store, try and unload a couple of books. Not super hot, but hotter than normal. You know how there's that range of books that if you had to go buy it somewhere, you would probably pay, you know, 10, 15 bucks for it type of thing. But we had no luck. I mean, we sold stuff, but at the end of the day, with all the hubbub and hassle, you know, it's literally a few dollars. So, also because I split it with him, because he already had the store and knows how to post and is willing to deal with all that. So I've decided that the high-end stuff is still worth it, but I don't know how people make a go on, like, $5 books on eBay.
You
must have to sell a lot of them.
This is the thing. I don't understand, and I've seen it broken down for me, but still, to me, like, you have to have a serious motivation and serious passion to, like, be making, like, $2 a book or whatever, and then to sell, like, that quantity, and your time. And, like,
the time alone.
Oh, no, it's great. It's great. But then you're like, yeah, it works out if you do it, if you're, like, really good at it. But I'm like, the amount of effort and time, I just think there's easier ways to make money.
I think it must be a lot of places that have, like, a physical store, too. And I wonder if they're also selling better books. Like, yeah, they sell a few of the $5 and $10 ones, but they're also selling the real, the nice books, you know, the $50, $100, $200 books. And that's probably helps because, man, I thought about, you know, you got to take photos of them, write up a description, put it on. Like, it was so much hassle that I was like, well, it was fun as an experiment to see. But those are now going back in the donate pile. Because I always felt weird donating. Because I always quickly check the book to make sure it's not some crazy hot book. And I always had a few that were not crazy hot, but like, oh, these are going more than cover price, purportedly. But then,
tell you about some of those off air.
Let me tell you, Andy can't get more than cover. They may charge that much, but I don't know. And the other thing is, you don't, maybe I missed the window or whatever. And they do sell, unlike all my other ones, which I doubt would even sell. But, you know, to make a dollar on a comic, arguably at best, seems, you know, I was lucky to get cover price on some of them. I didn't ever sell for over cover, so maybe I just picked wrong. But then again, it was part of it. It wasn't, I didn't buy those books thinking they would make money. I just bought them because I wanted to read them. And then I'm, you know, cutting down the comics I have. And it turns out, oh, you know, if these are worth something, instead of just giving them away, maybe I'll make a couple bucks. And no, not worth the effort.
hey, speaking of, you just reminded me of something. Speaking of die, boy, that's popped. Who knew? Remember I told you I was just going to file it away for 10 years until the movie?
Yeah. Wait,
who
so
knew?
Has die, like the book we've been reviewing on this show,
it's hot.
Like, it's a hot book.
It's gone to the fifth printing now.
I don't know. Does that mean anything though?
Yeah. It does. It's right now. It's a semi lukewarmish popular book.
Now, should I run out and get, like, is there a hot printing? It's like the third printing or something, the one that everyone's scrambling for. Was I a fool to buy the first printing, Kevin?
You're never a fool to buy the first printing.
Because it seems like now that people want weird stuff.
Well, you know what? If you bought the fourth printing, chuck your fourth printings in the garbage and wait for the sixth printing.
Kevin's hot tips. I like this segment.
Please, no one do that. Comics in a garbage.
No, it's too. Stick to this bit. I like it.
No, but that's what my joke was always like. Always wait till the last printing. Always be the last one to the party.
Yeah. Well, who would have thought that people would be so interested in newsstand editions? You know, those when there was that overlap with newsstand versus direct market. Those always seem to be worth more.
You think that's nuts? Wait till we start emailing Leaf Insect Man to send us all his Australian comics, because those are the, you know, people are going to want those. Or the, oh, those Pence books. People are going to want those books.
I like, I always, whenever I go, like, getting those foreign reprints, they're always so much fun. They're kind of crazy, but I don't know if they have any market value. I do see Canadian versions sometimes in these different auctions every time. And I'm like, wow. I wonder if you have to pay more or less. More. That's why I'm always careful, because I'm like, I don't want to buy, like, the Canadian Hulk 181 or whatever and end up, like, nobody wants this man.
But I think some people are like, oh, all the price variants are going to be, like, valuable. But the thing about the Canadian ones is, except for, like, minor changes, it's the same thing. Like, it doesn't look strange. And I kind of wonder if that's the reason why those were the first ones to go to, like, up, is because they look like the American copies. Like, there's not some weird, like, redrawn cover. I mean, those are cool. They look way better than the Canadian price variants because they're just so weird. But, you know how the market is.
Yeah, the nice thing about, like, the Canada, Australia, and England ones is they're still in a language I can understand, which helps. But, you know, when I went over to Italy, and it was kind of fun buying, like, an Italian version, but I can't really read it, so there's, other than the novelty of it, there is limited utility for me, and I would think that would also be a barrier, in that unless someone's getting it just as a collector item, or like me, novelty, there isn't going to be a lot of as much marketability that way.
Anyways, I think I derailed us with that die talk.
So, good show, though. Sounds
good. Yeah. Yeah, it was a fun show. Got to go out, do a few things that I don't normally do, so that was good.
Wait, what does that mean? You were always so cryptic. Like, do you end up in a gang where you have to, like, murder a homeless man or something? Like,
it's like Deadly Class.
Exactly. So, should we talk comic books?
So, I don't know if you read the same ones that I read.
Well, only one way to find out.
Okay, you go first.
Well, I know there's one, and I wish Phil was here, because I'm sure he bought it. Another one of these Canada Beats Up the United States comics.
You know, well, I was in a semi-sleep coma yesterday. I believe I read this one. And I wonder if that influenced this comic at all.
Well, we'll find out. And the book we're talking about is from Image Comics. Sadly, we need to branch out a little bit. We need to stop with all this Image nonsense.
Hey, I went to the Beguiling. This was their pick of the week.
Yeah, and it's Little Bird Chapter 1. Not Issue 1, Chapter 1. Although I do love in the postscript in the comic, they note that in addition to soliciting for feedback, which they're going to respond to, at least on social media if they don't have room to print them in the book, they want to make it very clear that it will not be collected in a, quote, typical trade paperback anytime in the near future.
That was a very specific wording, Andrew.
Yes, I somehow suspect there will be some sort of collection in the near future.
I'm thinking if you're going by a cost per page value and it comes out in, like, a super artist edition size, that's probably not the one you're looking for if you're waiting to save money in a trade.
But this is Darcy Von Paul Geest, Ian Bertram, Matt Hollingsworth on colors. That's a name I'm recognize. The other two names do not bring anything to mind, but Matt Hollingsworth, it does a lot of color work.
What? No, the part of the reason they picked this up, I thought, was the artwork. But
oh, that was the artwork for me. I just didn't know the artist, but I saw the cover, and I was like, oh, it's that kind of fiddly kind of James Stokoe.
Oh.
Lots of pretty little squiggly lines and detail, or
really?
Almost mixed with more of a anime type of Miyazaki kind of vibe to it, I felt.
See, I was going to say, you don't read comics from the Distinguished Competition?
Do I? Oh, I just read New Teen Titans and Green Lantern.
So you don't read Batman comics?
I'm taking a hiatus. I think I've mentioned before. In the 80s, I read you know, 5 Batman comics a month or whatever between Batman, Detective, Outsiders, and all the other ones. So, you know, need a break from the caped and cowl. Why is Bertram a regular Batman artist?
I've seen him on some of those books. Like, not, I don't think for a run, but something like Batman Eternal or whatever. He would be like a guy to come in and do an issue. Like, if they're like, Batman's in Argentina this month or whatever, right?
Yeah, it would definitely, I think I would enjoy Batman. Like I said, I like the fiddly detail with a little bit of what I feel to be anime in the figures.
Hmm. Work. See, I thought he was, his artwork also reminds me of like the Frank Quitely, Chris Burnham, those type
okay,
of guys.
Okay, yes, too. I can see those two as well. That's a fair, Chris Burnham is a good pull. I like that. Good call, Kevin. I agree with that. I was thinking the anime thing, because sometimes I notice on the bigger pages, it's interesting to see what detail they put in and what detail they put out.
Yeah.
And I feel like in the Western world, generally the bigger scenes are super detailed. Like, very few options are removed from them. Not saying that's better or worse, but I notice, and then in some of the anime, they'll really just have very bare representations on those big scenes. You know, the faces will just be a couple of dots type of thing.
I don't think I'm mistaken, but I don't think they solicited this as a Canada type of thing. Like, remember that other book, the, what was it? United We Stand or something?
Yeah, the BKV, K. Vaughan book.
Wasn't that explicit in what it was? I don't think this one was until the week it was coming out when I found out about it.
Oh, I only found out about it when it was on in the comic shop and I saw a very cool opening cover, which is the title character in her battle gear, which, like I said, that's giving me kind of a Nausicaa, because it's got a face like a gas mask sort of thing and a big fur coat that's more almost like a cloak, and then all this hair on top and 2 bloody knives sticking out. Yeah, and I was like, boy, that's a cool cover, I gotta get it. Then when I read it and it was the typical pro-Canada, anti-US, I'm like, yeah, that's that tracks. That's the current trend in comics. So we have
I remember seeing it in previews, and like, the solicits just, I don't know. It just, usually for books, sometimes there's solicits that grab me and don't grab me, and sometimes I'm totally wrong. But it just seemed like it was good versus evil. Like, that was basically a description, and then I'm like, okay.
Yeah, that's how I described it.
Yeah, and then, like, I see the preview pages, I'm like, that looks good. But I'm like, I don't know who the author is, and then I'm like, that description does nothing for me. So with all the other stuff that was happening that month, I didn't end up buying it. But then, like, what usually happens with some of these things, like, when I'm actually in the moment or at a shop, then that's the moment, like, really the moment when I'll decide if I'm gonna purchase it.
Yeah, that for me is all the time.
Of course.
There's precious, when I heard that, obviously there are certain creators when I hear they're working on something that I'm like, oh, if I come across that, I'm definitely going to buy it type of thing. Like GoBots, which we're going to have Kevin Explains GoBots to the Andy segment when that series is finished.
Yeah. Maybe it'll be an all GoBots episode. I don't know. We'll have to see what we're going to do there.
I think I might need some help figuring out what's going on. But this one is post-apocalyptic future. U.S. has gone theocracy and invaded at least North America. So there's a couple of freedom fighters in Canada holding out. The good guys, the Canadians. And in a last-ditch stand, one village is wiped out except for the main character, Little Bird. And she was put in hiding before the last assault, which killed lots of people. And she comes out of her hiding to find everything wiped out. Not necessarily unlike, remind me a little bit, except she comes out by herself, as opposed to getting rescued by Saul Guerrera, but the recent Star Wars prequel, which featured the how did the rebels get the Star Wars death plans, the Death Star plans. But I will stop Star Wars talk because I know that's not Kevin's thing.
I have no idea what you just said.
So she has the formulation of what was her mother's plan. So she, and that involves freeing this formidable Canadian freedom fighter known as the Axe. So that's what she proceeds to do all by herself. And in the interim, we find out that her mother did not perish in the attack, but has some sort of connection, and I will keep it vague, and I think it's kept somewhat vague in the book, with the leader of the American theocracy. And then It ends with a particularly bizarre scene of our main character dying? Not dying? Kevin? I don't know. Our main character takes a possibly fatal blow.
Yeah. It kind of goes in, like, Luther Strode territory towards the end of the book. Or Jeff Darrow? Like, it kind of goes... I don't know.
Yeah, the book is pretty violent. That's what you're beating around to. Lots of, and particularly, like, bloody violence.
Yeah.
Like, characters get eviscerated, and there's pools of blood, and they're covered in it when they attack these different characters.
I mean, you can kind of tell some of that is going to go on from the cover, but maybe you would just think, like, that's just, like, an interesting cover rather than something that would happen inside.
And I've bagged on other colors for doing this, but I think Hollandsworth strikes a nice balance of having a predominantly kind of themed colors. And I think part of it is it's a very kind of light palette. Like the colors are almost subdued in a way. So I think that helps. And it's not quite so domineering using the like themed color. Particularly when she goes to bust the main person out of the jail. Some of the other segments do feel like they're really colored in all one color or a variation. But I thought Hollingsworth did a good job, because I know I've been getting down on colorists lately for, I feel, being a little too heavy-handed at times. And I thought he showed great restraint that complemented the artwork. And no offense to them other colorists too, it's just my dumb opinion anyways. But I'm, like I said, I'm trying not to be, you know, focus on positive things, but also call out, you know, maybe other people share my feelings on these things. I don't know, but that's the whole point of this. But the thing I found interesting too, and I don't know, I assume your version has this, the inside back cover is a representation of issue 2, but it's without colors. I think it's not. Like I said, I've enjoyed Hollingsworth colors, but I feel like looking at that, they could have also done this book in black and white, too.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, I think Bertram really has a solid command. And like I said, I enjoyed the colors, no knock. I'm not trying to start no business here or anything. And it definitely didn't subtract from anything. But that lets me know that, man, this would have been a fun black and white book, too. But I guess then you wouldn't have all the red blood everywhere.
Wait, you just revealed what their reprinting of this would be, a black and white with red blood.
That would be, I don't, sometimes those single color things are always a little goofy. But anyway, what did you enjoy it? What did you think, Kevin?
People are going to enjoy this book more.
I mean, I know you like the fact that the Canadians are the good guys and the Americans are the bad guys, but past that point.
Except for those Darren Cook and Jeff Lemire Mountie stories and Jonah Hex, where the Canadians are the bad guys, right?
Well, we don't consider them to be in continuity anymore.
Okay. Yeah, it was fine. I this is one of those things where someone else would have to tell me if this, like, I could see this getting awards or people saying this is really great, and it was like pick of the week at the Beguiling, so like maybe it is a great book, but I kind of feel like when I read Blankets or something, I'm like, I can take enjoyment from it, but is it engaging me on all the levels that I look for when I'm reading a comic? No. Why? Maybe that's me.
Like, no,
I don't know. Like,
I do feel I have the same hesitation in that I could see this book turning better or worse. I feel like it really is a first taste, because if the storytelling gets very fractured and leaves a lot of questions, that will not be to my set. I don't really like those ones where you can't tell what's going on. So, yeah. As I told you, it ends in that end. And if it moves more in that direction, I will be probably stop reading it. But if it moves more into unveiling the mystery of how these characters are created and describing the world in better detail, I think I will. So I can see your point about the first issue is a taste, but it doesn't really tell you, is this going to be like a regular linear story or more like a fever dream or something?
And also, like, the plot device of like the villain of the story, I'm like, I don't know, that doesn't, I don't know.
the clapped out religious nut is not your thing. Yeah, I feel like that is not, it's not the first time we've seen.
No, I don't know. Like, I can't fault the artwork. The artwork's, like, awesome, and storytelling's great, and, like, all the, like, there's other things, all those other pieces are here. It's kind of weird that if it was a different story, all these same creators, like, I could probably say that, like, I really enjoyed it, but just the way this came together, I'm just like, I just know other people are going to enjoy this more than I did.
All right, so are you going to pick up two, or are you going to wait in here? Are you going to wait for it'll not be collected soon in a regular trade or whatever?
I'm probably going to wait.
That makes sense. That last statement didn't sit great with me either, because I do feel it was like cleverly worded to protect them. And look, I get that they need floppy sales to guarantee its survival, but I would have much preferred that pitch to the, well, you better buy it this way or you're never going to see it implication. Like I said, cleverly worded to be not, because we all hate, I remember sorry, my mind just went blank, but there was that pay what you want digital comic. Where they made a big deal about, like, oh, this won't be in print. And then...
Yeah. 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 The Private Eye?
Yes, that was it.
Yeah.
And that's why I don't like when people make those sorts of statements, because, you know, tell us what you think. That, look, we don't have plans now. You know, could it happen in the future? Maybe.
Yeah, I think that's better saying, like, right now we don't have any plans. Like, I think that's always, you know, because who knows, or what happens, right?
Yeah, and I just feel that otherwise it ends up feeling like they were trying to quote unquote trick us or something, and just be smart. Or, and like I said, I'm susceptible to the pitch of, hey, look, if this book doesn't meet certain numbers quotas, it won't likely get traded. That's a very fair and likely true statement. Do something like the Brubaker thing where he puts added value in the floppies.
Yeah, I feel like you almost have to trade at this point to see where your market is.
I think so too. I mean, isn't that, if anything, that we learned from Jim Zub's frequent tweeting about Skull Kickers was the sheer importance of that, especially the discounted first trade.
I'm thinking, like, if you're a micro press or some really small indie X guy, then like that trade isn't necessarily coming. But if you're any sort of publisher, yeah, I'm thinking you're putting a trade out for your stuff. Yeah, or someone else is.
There's too many readers that's the only market of. But with those indie guys, sometimes it isn't, the story doesn't suit itself to trade because it might only be one issue or two, or their love of unusual sizes may also be a barrier. Maybe in today's world, it doesn't matter if you picked a funky size and the printing costs are roughly the same, but I do imagine that it's got to be at least a little bit cheaper if you're using standard sizing. I don't know. That's just my guess. Like I said, I haven't ordered print jobs or whatever, but I'd have to think. Maybe it's not huge, but there's some advantage to picking a regular, quote-unquote regular size.
On a sort of unrelated note, I thought it was kind of cool to see Copra show up at Image.
Yeah, that's... It's fun how when you hit on something, comics are great at keeping it around and keeping it in print and keeping it recycling and... Or recycle it to other TV or films or whatever. Like, there's something fun about... Once it's out there and in some format, you know, you can still reap benefits. There's always new readers.
But I'm like, that's crazy. Like, 30 issues and then end, like, trades that I was able to order through the comic shop and everything. And now it's, like, reprints or... I guess whatever left of the other...
Yeah, I'm going to have to try it again. I remember when he had the first issue on the website, and I enjoyed it, but I didn't... I think it might have been one of those ones, and I definitely need education on how to manage expectation.
Yeah.
Because I feel like so many times I have high expectations, and it submarines what's probably a very fine book, but that's part of why I like my system of just going and kind of buying comics off the rack. Because I hope it helps tamper. Because every time I get pumped for something, I feel like I'm sabotaging it and holding it to impossible standards.
Well, this is the other funny thing, Andrew. Well, I enjoyed, really, really enjoyed, like, I love going to cons. I love digging through bins and, like, pulling out, like, something I've never seen before and buying it. Like, it's hard to, like, get to... It, like, that's that joy, you know? And as fun as that was, it was crazy knowing I only had, like, 15 minutes at the Beguiling and trying to find and buy as many comics as I could in a very tight window and then leave. Like that was absolute excitement, too. So it's so weird.
It's fun. It's fun going into the store and something like Little Bird. Like, I knew nothing about it. And that probably helped. Like, if it had been hyped up before I got there or whatever. But I just saw it and it helps. Where those books where I'm like, oh, I've heard this is great or whatever. It always seems like I'm setting myself up to be disappointed. Or maybe I'm just expecting one thing or the other. I mean, it still happens. There are still books that and sometimes I know, too. For instance, I don't know if you picked up Morning in America.
No.
But that's Visaggio and Aguirre. Claudia Aguirre is one of the Boudicca Comics people. So I really like their art. But Visaggio has done writing with different members of that team. And her books haven't rung true with me. So it was one of those ones that I knew going in, like, oh, I really like one half of the team. And again, really love the art. But the story, and it's not like it's bad or anything, but I think the themes explored, mostly because, again, this is like, it's about high school kids. And I guess I just have, like, zero interest in a story, particularly if it's too close to, it has to be such a heightened and bizarre reality, but something set in a relatively regular, normal world with the only addition being, you know, whatever weird elements they want to fleck in is not interested. So this is set in Tucker, Ohio in 1983. So, like, teenagers in the 80s, just not... And the ironic thing, I know I was a teenager in the 80s.
You were?
For parts of it, yes. A significant, you know, so you would think, oh, this would be... Not 83 would have been... This is pitched a couple years before my time, but not so much that it's unrecognizable. But I just have zero interest in that sort of setting. But I really, you know, those Boudica comics artists, wherever they go, and I always do enjoy their artwork. So I was kind of, I knew kind of going in, and I don't think, I don't know. Maybe I'll get issue two. I don't know. But the problem is I really am only there for the art. And that's hard in a comic book medium. Although I will say the other way almost never works for me. If it's only the writer I like and I can't stand the art, there's no question that I'm unlikely to.
I always feel like I'm like picking a fight with like writers or artists, because like one side or the other will have some big statement on comic books. And I'm always like, no, comics are writers and artists. But I don't know.
Well, it's hard. I mean, you must admit that in some books, one of the elements appeals to you. Like, is it 50-50 on every book? You're like, I like the art just as much as the writing. Or, you know, how do you feel about it? Or do you feel there's sometimes books where the art appeals to you more than the writing?
I always think the ideal comic is like if both are great, like you're getting something that both of them never would have been able. I shouldn't say like oh, there's two people or whatever. Like there could be one person,
right? Sure, or yeah, five people if it's a Marvel's 90s book and they need a bunch of anchors to finish.
But assuming it's not one person, because one person then like it's not the same conversation. Like it's one person.
Right.
But if it's like two people, then like you get something that's greater than they could have done on their own, or it's just something they would have never done on their own because of whatever they're into or whatever. They would have never thought of certain things. So you get something crazy that you would have never had in the first place. That's awesome. And I always think that's way more important than either one by itself.
True, there's a synergy, but yeah. That's dodging my question about whether when you pick up a book, do you ever feel that one aspect of the book outshadows the other?
Sometimes.
So in those instances, does it matter to you which one overshines the other as to whether you're going to continue the book or not?
It depends how strong one side or the other is. Like, there's always... stories that like the artwork is too bad and all, I'm like, I can't continue like this. Like, I'm not
true.
I'm not
gonna... and I think most people would say yes, but I'm talking where there's like this Morning America, it's not like the writing is like it's just not for me. Like, it's not like it's poorly executed or what, not well done. It just doesn't appeal to me, but the artwork does. So that's more the interest I'm doing. Obviously, if it's, you know, you hired me to draw your comic book, the art would be dreadful and have mistakes and probably be indecipherable at times. So those are clearly failings that are past subjective tastes. I'm talking about more of the subjective realm. And we've talked about books where sometimes it's like, you know, this sequence, I don't understand what happened. It's not clear. I need someone to explain to me, like, how this character ended up over there versus that type of thing.
But sometimes if you're good enough as an artist, like, I'm like, I'll overlook that because you're so amazing. But usually when we point out those things, they're not, like, our superstars. Like, sure. I can't think of an example. Maybe someone else could, where... It was, but I don't think usually we've said that.
No, and look, everybody had, I'm sure everybody had a bad panel here or there, but yeah. I'm talking about more systemic book-wide failures. And again, I want to point out, Morning in America from Oni is not poorly written or anything in that. It's just not a subject area of which I find interest currently. And who knows, maybe next year I'll be like, give me all them high school. I think that's been a barrier for me in like the Archie books too. Except for the horror, which again is some usually very heightened unreality. Just the regular day-to-day, who's dating who, and my parents don't understand me, and all that stuff. And
you mean Nick Spencer didn't ruin Archie?
He may have. I don't know. I don't want to take that away from Nick. And it wasn't like I always disliked those books, but I just feel like at this point in the calendar year, or at my age, or whatever, high school books that don't have a significantly altered reality or something are not. And maybe I'm just too far from those days. It's been a long time since I was 16. And so the thought of, and they're valid stories and should be examined. And it's good to have stories focused on younger people because they're the future and everything. But I don't, much the same way I wouldn't fault any teenager who didn't want to read something about one of them comics about a mid-40s having a midlife crisis guy. I don't know that I want to read those comics either, mind you. I more generally prefer, I guess I, maybe my thing about comics is I really do prefer when they're focused more on unrealities, now that I think about it. I mean, not that, I mean, we've all read some good autobio comics, but for me, they have to be people that have had extraordinary lives, like the one I was talking about, the senator who was in the civil rights and march in Alabama and got beaten by cops. Like, he really had a dramatically different, important life. And that might be my problem. Maybe I'm a snob. But I also feel like I live a regular life. Like, I don't need to read a comic about regular losers. Like, I am a regular loser.
Yeah, but it's done really well, though. I would totally want to read about a regular loser.
I don't know, but do you read a lot of those? I mean, you do like the art comics, but do you like the art comics where they're just autobio, like...
Are they... This is the thing, Andrew. Are they art comics? Like... You look at something like Copra or whatever, I'm like, yeah, that's like in, like, someone's not going to mistake that for like regular comics, but there still must be some sort of pushback from guys, right?
I don't know. I mean, as I told you, the last time I went to one of those things, I felt really out of place. I knew I was the enemy. They don't want some idiot that reads Capes and Cowls there. I'm the bad guy, Kevin.
There's always a moment every TCAF where you sort of scoot along and you feel out of place. Yeah. It happens every year. Like, that might just be me. I don't know if that happens to everyone. I'm like the Marble Noise guy.
Exactly.
Invading their myth, looking for... like monster comics or science fiction comics or superhero comics.
Super. I mean, is there anything lower to them than a superhero comic?
I've repeatedly got superhero commissions at these shows, but only from certain people.
Right. And there are people that straddle both worlds, clearly. You know, your Jeff Lemire's, your Matt Kent's, your all those guys. Your Copra, Fife's doing the G.I. Joe. Like, there are Tom Trolley.
That's what I mean. It's so weird. Like, there's the group of indie artists, like, where it's not just that they like superheroes. It's like they like a specific brand of superheroes or characters from an era that other people really dislike, or from an era that people want to forget about. And that's a whole other different level. Like, that's not just saying I like Spider-Man, that's saying I like Deadpool or Cable or whatever. Like, that's a whole other reaction from people.
The art, yeah. Well, anyway, if you find some, well, isn't I guess to your point, isn't Pope hat's a great example. Does that have a height in reality, or is that just... That might be your example of regular stuff happening to regular people.
I really enjoyed, Pope hats.
Yeah, Andy, really no interest. Regular people doing regular things.
Yeah, no. But that falls into my category. It's done really well, so I really enjoy it. Yeah, it's just regular people doing regular jobs, having regular lives. But I don't know. But it's really well done, so I enjoy it. I don't know if stuff is the... Since I'm not a lawyer, does that count as... But that doesn't work for TV or anything. Like, I usually find those things boring. I mean, it works for Daredevil, not that he's super lawyer all the time.
You do love the lawyer stuff with Daredevil. That is your favorite part. Well,
this is the funny thing. This probably maybe isn't super relevant to Indy. But if you look at Daredevil, religious stuff that I don't go for. Lawyer stuff that I don't go for. But really love the Daredevil.
Oh, come on. You didn't love when the Fantastic Four has to go to Daredevil for legal advice about their building.
I do. I love that. Love that part.
See?
So there is a way to write certain things that I'm not normally... Of course, a big thing about Daredevil is there's a heavy crime element.
Really?
And it's not like... it's not pure, that comic is not pure superhero. It's many things.
Well, to be fair, most superhero comics lean into something else to help pad the bones on it. But anyways, maybe I've realized something about me and that I need a lot more. And there is some heightened reality behind Morning in America. I believe it's some mystery about some kids go missing. But it wasn't heightened enough for me. Like, if they go missing in the first issue because a space monster's there, well, then maybe I'm on board. But to vaguely allude that it might be some... Or you can have a mystical fake-out, but even then I tend to get irritated. Like, the True Detective Season 1, the ending bothered me when they faked it out and it wasn't some kind of magical monster or something.
It would have been better if it was some monster, wouldn't it?
Yeah, I like a world. I like my fantasy worlds where they have my time away from reality. I like it to be away from reality, I guess.
So then how did you ever become a Marvel fan with their "We're in your world"? This is the thing when people always
go, they're the most ridiculous comics ever.
Like, if people really wanted to like escape when they're reading their comics, like they can't read, like there's certain things they can't read. And one of the things they definitely should be reading is just imaginary stories where people have ant heads and everything. Like, if they want something totally divorced from reality. That's not usually what they mean when they say that.
Superhero comics are so divorced from... Yes, it's some world that has the same cities or this, that, or the other thing. But they are not anything at all like the real world. The first time some... And they always try those, like, wow, what if Superman was in the real world? And they're fun for, like, a couple of issues. But the point is, the introduction of any of those elements would change our world so it would be unrecognizable. So that's the lie of superhero comics. It's our world, but with superheroes. Well, that can't exist. If our worlds had superheroes, it would be so different, we wouldn't recognize it as our world. So, yeah, it's just one of those lies they tell us. And that's fine. I don't...
That's why some of a Valiant Comics world, there's certain significant changes that happen because it's supposed to be somewhat the world outside your window, but then when they do something, it really changes things.
Yeah, that's the thing. Like, if any of these things, because we've seen in our lifetimes much dramatic actions which are on a par with, like, some, you know, if some supervillain held the world at random, we've seen how. Particularly the United States has reacted to threats against it and everything. If there really were superpowered buffoons, like, everything would just be so different, who could imagine it? And that's, I think, a mistake that sometimes modern comics forget that lie, and they want to be like, yeah, let's put a real world event in. And it feels fake in some ways, because the real world event has antecedents in the real world that couldn't have existed in the Marvel. You know what I mean? It's a weird line. I feel it's hard to walk because it isn't our world with super. It's not the world outside our window.
And it doesn't. It seems more unique and startling in our world compared to a world where that happens. Like other equal crazy things happen all the time.
Yeah. So, you know, they have a guy with a giant G on his belt shows up and threatens to eat the planet or whatever. So we all get mind wiped into forgetting. And then later on, someone will be like, yeah, but there was that one guy who can't forget that it happened. And now I'm going to build a 6-issue arc out of it. You know, and that's all fine. But I think that the best stories remember that it's a different reality that only superficially mimics our world. And so those, to me, are the better comics than the ones that are like, well, what if he really was here? Oh, please. Who? It would be such a different reaction. And also, it's not, I think comics work best with that sort of heightened, different reality because they're not movies or TV shows, they're comics. How they tell stories and play with time should always be in consideration. That's what makes them great.
What if someone wanted to make comics serious, grim and gritty, though, and totally tear down the heroic ideal of superheroes?
That'll never happen.
Do that for a limited series for a publisher. You know, because I love these heroes, so they're just gonna tear them down and destroy that idea.
Yes, wasn't that?
I think that would be a pretty popular seven issue limited series in the early 2000s. I think.
Oh, I thought you were talking about Watchmen. I'm like, that's 12 issues. But and either way, it's all common ground, and it's interesting because the good ones of those also were dealing with tearing down the superhero idea as it exists in the superhero world. Because again, it's not our reality, it's this weird mirror universe that has certain superficial similarities to ours, and certain deeper similarities, but it is not our world with superheroes in it. And I feel like those are things that people forget, but we're talking an awful lot about superhero books, so I should switch topics quickly. And I wanted to drop a hint about a couple of Kickstarters. I'm channeling my inner Super Steve. Because I bet you Super Steve has backed these. And we discussed his previous Kickstarter, but Rick Geary is back with a new Kickstarter, and it's going to end on April 18th.
Wow.
And he is just about there. He's like less than $150 away. So hopefully, by the time I post this, this also sets a ticking clock for Andy to edit it. And then beg Kevin to and Indie Comic Book Noise to post it, which takes just about as long as me editing it.
This is true. Who knows? We would be on schedule.
Yes. Well, I know you and the Sentient Podcast both have strong feelings about when episodes go up. I don't know who I need to lobby more, you or the Twitter account for the show.
Like. You probably the Twitter account, because at this point I'm starting to believe you. Like, I was just like, I don't trust anyone to be on schedule ever, and then like it keeps on happening that we're on schedule. So I'm like, maybe they can be trusted, but if you try to convince like a computer that no, I can be trusted, they keep on looking at the data from the last 5 years, and they I guess they still don't believe.
But we've
got old logic.
It's called the Wallace Mystery. The person that actually hosts these is Mark Rosenbaum, Rosenbohm. But if you search Rick Geary, Geary, I'll put a link to this in the notes, or Wallace Mystery, or Mark Rosenbaum, you'll find it pretty quickly. And like a lot of these, it'll show you samples of the artwork and what you get. And Steve and I got the last one and talked a lot about it. I hope he's backing this one. You may be able to get it through other means if you don't want to do this, but he really does, like last time and again this time, a little postcard and signs them and makes it all nice. Like, it really feels like you're having a connection, whether that's real or not, or manufactured, I don't know. But the other thing is the scope of these tend to make it believable that he could be really investing this kind of time and energy in the rewards. Because it's not like there's a million backers. You know, currently it's less than 150. Now it'll end up north of that, of course, but even if it was 300, you could do a personalizing for 300 without, it wouldn't be unbelievable or anything. The other thing I wanted to mention that is the first created, to my understanding, but I'm sure Super Steve is backing it, is Mike Grell is collecting Maggie the Cat, who was a character from John Sable. And we've talked extensively about John Sable. I probably should have pulled up those episode numbers. But hey, I know you Indie Noise comic book lovers love how loose and free they are. But that has met its goal already, $15,000. It's north of that. So guaranteed to go, and that one expires Sunday, April 21st. So I should, again, if I have the other one out, I'll have this one out. But we, Steve and I have talked a lot about John Sable. Maggie the Cat's fun. I think we've covered her first appearance with that. This collects the 1996 Image of the Cat series plus 10 pages of new story and art. So even if you are, have that original, and I do not, I don't think I do. Maybe I do. But if I do, let's get a new one. Now I will say, in all likelihood, this will probably find its way in other media. So if you're like, I don't really want to back a Kickstarter, I imagine, given its current success, you'll be able to find this somehow. I can't promise that. And if you want it, and I backed it, and I suggest you do too, but given its quick success and its previous collection, there's a fair chance in 6 months it's in comic book stores from Image or some other publisher or whatever. But I think John Sable, that world was fun. I really liked it. And I felt that the pricing was fair. But like I said, if you're on a budget, maybe you can wait. So Maggie the Cat, Mike Grell. Again, this is put together by Nathan Jerome.
All right. Sounds like an episode.
And I chased off Kevin.
I mean, I feel like this has gone on long enough.
Gone on long enough. Gone on too long. But
I know, right? And I still have comics, but I don't know. Maybe we can schedule another episode if that's what we do now. I don't know. We'll see.
We'll see. But thanks for listening, folks. Kevin, did you want to, you know, that our erstwhile former podcast sparring mates at Earth 2 gave you a suggested catchphrase to steal?
Oh, right. Yeah, I thought they had one.
But my catchphrase is always, thanks for listening.
What?
Which, you know, isn't really much of a catchphrase, I guess.
No, but it's nice to thank people. Yeah, I thought our friends at Earth 2 said, keep developing sentience. It's good for you. And point at someone and tell them they're to blame. All hail Computo.
It's morning again in America. Today, more men and women will go to work than ever before in our country's history. With interest rates at about half the record highs of 1980, nearly 2,000 families today will buy new homes, more than at any time in the past 4 years. This afternoon, 6,500 young men and women will be married. And with inflation at less than half of what it was just 4 years ago, they can look forward with confidence to the future. It's morning again in America. And under the leadership of President Reagan, our country is prouder and stronger and better. Why would we ever want to return to where we were less than 4 short years ago?